Hey, thank you, and I appreciate the invitation to come and share some of our work today, especially the mixed crowd. We get a lot of mixed crowds in the Center for Systems Biology at Duke, so it's a lot of fun. Please stop me if you have a question during the seminar. There's no reason for me to continue if you don't know what's going on, so feel free to jump in. All right, so my lab's interested in the fundamental mechanisms that control cell division, and more specifically, what I'm going to talk about today is our interest in trying to understand the nature of the cell cycle clock or oscillator. And what I mean by cell cycle clock or oscillator is the mechanism that ensures that all of the cell cycle events that are triggered in this temporal program during cell division cycle are triggered at the right time and in the right order. Now, if you mess up this program of events, you lose genome stability, which is, of course, the driving force in tumorigenesis. All right, so it's pretty widely believed, or has been for some time, that at the core of this cell cycle clock is a protein complex called cyclin CDK. And this is Tim Hunt, who shared the Nobel Prize a number of years ago for his work in identifying the cyclin CDK complex and his work in showing that it formed part of the central core of the oscillator for early embryonic cells. All right. So just by way of review for some of you and probably new for others, in its simplest form, the cyclin CDK complex has two components. It has a CDK, which is the catalytic subunit. So this is the component that phosphorylates target proteins. And it has a cyclin, which binds to it. And the cyclin is thought to do two things for this complex. And the first, as the name suggests, it's required to activate the kinase. And it's also thought to be involved in substrate targeting. So if you bind different cyclins to the same CDK, they'll target different substrates and trigger different events. Now finally, this complex acts as a molecular switch by putting phosphates onto proteins. It changes their conformation, it can turn them on, turn them off, and the cyclin CDK complex clearly is involved in triggering all of the events that we think about when we think about the cell division cycle, such as DNA replication and mitosis. All right. So let's start with a very simple cell cycle oscillator model and have a look at how this complex plays a role in the cell cycle clock. And this is the very simple kind of textbook model that I actually pinched this from David Morgan's textbook on the cell cycle. This is the one we teach all of our undergraduate students. And this model actually comes from the study of embryonic systems, and they actually do a rather specialized cell division cycle. They cycle back and forth simply between S phase and M phase. All right, so they're doing DNA synthesis and then they're doing mitosis. There are no G1 or G2 phases in these early cleavage embryos. All right, so how does this oscillator work? These early cleavage embryos are filled up with maternal RNAs, and the dominant cyclin in these early cleavage embryos is cyclin B, and cyclin B is synthesized at a pretty steady rate from maternal stores of RNA. When it reaches its peak, it activates CDK1. When CDK1 gets activated, there's through some delay mechanism that isn't super well understood, it then activates another complex called APC. And this is different than the APC that most of our tumor biologists might know about. This is the anaphase promoting complex, APC-CDC20. It's an E3 ubiquitin ligase that puts ubiquitin chains onto cyclin B and triggers its destruction. All right? So this is a pretty simple and straightforward negative feedback oscillator. And you can hang other bells and whistles off of this, and John can tell you a lot more about that than I can, but pretty straightforward negative feedback oscillator. One other thing I want to point out is not only is cyclin B CDK1 playing a role in this oscillator, but it's also functioning as an effector of this oscillator. So this is a complex that's phosphorylating all of the important substrates that you need to trigger mitosis. All right, central core of the oscillator and effector of the oscillator. All right, so early cleavage embryos don't get tumors. Somatic cells do, and so you really want to, what we're really interested in understanding is how somatic cell cycles work. And they have a couple of differences, distinct differences from these early cleavage embryos. First, they have an extended cell cycle period, so you're adding two cell cycle phases, G1 and G2. And we're really going for minutes in cell divisions from these early cleavage embryos. The periods are on the order of minutes, and we're going to hours in these somatic cell cycles. And as well, we now have multiple cyclins and multiple CDKs in metazoan cells. So we use budding yeast as a model system to study the cell cycle, and you should be saying, well, budding yeast don't get tumors either. They don't, of course, but the budding yeast cell cycle works a lot like somatic cell cycles, and the cell cycle machinery is remarkably conserved from yeast to humans. All right, so let's take a quick look at the budding yeast cell cycle. What I'm showing you here is a graph of protein abundance for all of the cyclins. There are 9 different cyclins in budding yeast. And you can divide them up into 3 different categories based on their timing of expression and their function. The G1 cyclins, shown right here, there are 3 of them, clin 1, 2, and 3. These would be analogous to cyclin D, cyclin E. The S phase cyclins, clib 5, clib 6, shown here, they trigger S phase events, analogous to cyclin E, cyclin A. And the mitotic cyclins, of which there are 4, would be analogous to cyclin A, CDC2, cyclin B, CDC2. All right, so different waves of these cyclins are expressed throughout the cell cycle. This is actually a timeline as cells progress through the cycle. And all of the cyclins trigger all of these different events. And we won't be talking about too many of those today. One that I do want to talk about, I'm showing you on the bottom a budding yeast cell going through the cell cycle. They start off in early G1 as small round cells. Blue is DAPI, so that's DNA. Green is a GFP-tagged spindle pole, so that's the yeast version of the centrosome. And at the G1S border, the event I want to tell you about for yeast cell cycle biologists is budding. So right at the G1S border, these cells spit out a new bud. And that bud will continue to grow throughout the cell cycle and eventually become the new daughter cell in which the new nucleus is segregated into mitosis. All right, so we'll talk a little bit more about budding. All right, so now we've got cells, and this is a little less complicated than you see in mammalian cells, of course, that have multiple CDKs and many, many cyclins as well. All right, so now we have all these cyclins, we have extended period, the kinds of models that people draw for cell cycle oscillators, and again, this is David Morgan's version of the yeast cell cycle oscillator. Things get a little bit more complicated, and I just want to point out a couple of things. This is that negative feedback loop that I showed you before with the mitotic cyclin CDK and the APC. We can see other negative feedback loops. There's positive feedback loops. We see all kinds of potential oscillating mechanisms, perhaps all kind of linked together. And I was at a Gordon conference on cell proliferation last summer. Fred Cross referred to this as wheels inside of wheels. All right, and so one of the models that Fred's very interested in is that there are a number of potential oscillators that are all kind of working together. All right, so a number of years ago when I was a postdoc in Steve Reed's lab, I did an experiment that actually challenged this particular model. And I'd like to tell you I did the experiment because I'm very clever and I wanted to test this model, but that wouldn't be true. In fact, I was interested in studying DNA replication. But the experiment that I did was to knock out, and you can do this kind of ghoulish tinkering in yeast, knocked out all of the M cyclins, mitotic cyclins, and the S phase cyclins. All right, so now we get a cell that looks like this. Cells still have their G1 cyclins, but they couldn't undergo DNA replication because they have no S phase cyclins. They couldn't undergo mitosis because they have no M phase cyclins. But they do have their G1 cyclins, and they do a couple of G1 things. First is that they could activate genes that are normally transcribed in G1, and as well, they could trigger the emergence of a new bud. All right, so by contemporary kinds of cell cycle models, one would expect that these cells would trigger these events here at the G1S border and then arrest before they enter S phase. In fact, that's not what happens, and what we found is that these cells actually undergo a couple of periodic events that I'm going to tell you about. The first is budding, and this is a cell that's undergone 1, 2, 3 different budding cycles, and the buds are a little elongated here, and it's a trivial reason, so don't be distracted by that. So the most interesting part of these budding cycles is that the period between the emergence of the first bud and the second bud, and the second bud and the third bud, is very, very similar to a normal cell cycle period. Now, what we also found was when we looked at a couple of G1 transcripts is that they would turn on and turn off, and then there would be a delay, and then they would turn on and turn off again. And these transcriptional cycles occurred concurrently with the emergence of the new bud. So everything was happening in a kind of concerted way. All right, so this really doesn't fit with the kinds of oscillator models like I just showed you out of the textbooks. And in fact, in a paper a number of years ago, we proposed that the yeast cell cycle was entrained not to a cyclin CDK timer, but a cyclin CDK independent oscillator. So when I took my position at Duke, one of our big jobs was to figure out what this oscillator was. And of course, we had a number of different models, but one of the models that we favored, because we were seeing transcriptional dynamics, and because one of the best studied biological oscillators, the circadian oscillator, works by transcriptional feedback, we thought, okay, maybe this is working by transcriptional feedback. And if that was going to be true, we wanted to understand all the transcriptional dynamics. We did a couple of northern blots, pretty old school in this, and we wanted to know all of the transcriptional dynamics that were going on in these cells. And so we did an experiment in which we examined global transcription dynamics by microarray. And the way we did that experiment is we started with a synchronized population in early G1. We release the cells, take time points over time, and isolate RNA and throw each one of them, each time point down onto a chip. All right, so we first did that with wild-type cells, and it had been done before, but we didn't think the data were good enough to serve as a positive control for our experiments. And so this is wild-type cells, and I'm going to show you a couple of these heat maps, so I'll walk you through what it means before we get started. On the x-axis is a timeline, and we've mapped time points and all these columns down onto a timeline, and we converted time into a cell cycle timeline here. And on the y-axis, we're looking at it, each row is a gene. And this is the mRNA profile for each one of these genes. So this is log transform data. Yellow means that you're above the mean. Blue means that you're below the mean for expression for each one of those genes. All right? So two things I want you to see from this profile. One is that there's a temporal program of gene expression during the cell cycle. Genes start to be turned on here in G1. And then they're turned on continually. Other genes are turned on in S phase and then on through mitosis. So we have this kind of continuum of expression as cells go through the cycle. I should say that what we found was about 1,250 periodic genes. That's about 20% of the yeast genome. Pretty significant portion of the yeast genome. I actually think it's probably higher than that. All right, so we have this continuum of expression. Genes turn on, turn off, turn on again. So we're showing you about a cell cycle and a half worth of data here. And so two things, temporal order of expression, and then we see oscillation of expression. So what did we see when we did this experiment with mutant cells? Well, it was a rather big surprise, about 882 genes. That's about 70% of this wild-type program of genes were still expressed on schedule, even though these cells should be arrested at the G1S border. And that was a big surprise because at the time, it was thought that you get this program of gene expression, this temporal program of gene expression, by the activity of cyclin CDKs themselves. All right? So that data looks like this. So this is the cyclin mutants, and we're looking at the exact same genes as you go across here. So you're actually comparing wild type to mutant, same genes here. And we see this temporal order of expression, so this kind of continuum of expression, and we see genes turning on, turning off, and then turning on again. So we have oscillation, two behaviors. All right, so it's not the cyclin CDKs that are running this program and giving you these oscillations. What is it? So a few years back, there are a couple papers came out of Rick Young's lab and a few just heroic studies in which they took all of the known transcription factors in yeast. This is one of the benefits of working in yeast. It's about a little over 200 transcription factors, and they localized them across the genome by chip-on-chip analysis. Then they took that data and combined it with dynamic expression data, very much like the wild-type data that I showed you before, and they came up with a network model for how cells might give you this temporal program of transcription. And the way you do that is each one of these little nodes here represents a transcription factor. It's placed on the cell cycle timeline based on its time of expression, and this comes from transcription data. And then each one of these arrows means that this transcription factor binds in the promoter of the gene that encodes that transcription factor and activates it. So in this way, you could get a cascade, and this is just a highly simplified cartoon. you could get a cascade of transcription factors all turning each other on and turning on a number of other genes. Now, if you start to think naively about this, how would I turn this thing into an oscillator? You hook up the last transcription factor that's expressed in mitosis to one of the first transcription factors that you see in G1. All right? Yeah. Why there's five? I just made it up. It's a cartoon. Yeah, there's absolutely no reason to think of, yeah, I just made it up. All right. Okay, so we were very interested to see if we could take the data that we got from these cyclin mutant cells and build such a network that might explain the behaviors that we were seeing. And this data is published in a study from about a year and a half ago. And what we did, again, is we took transcription factors, and some of these are transcription factor complexes, and we aligned them on the cell cycle timeline based on their timing of their peak time of transcription. And then we wired these things up with either chip data from Rick Young's lab or from other experiments that other labs had done. And we used a pretty conservative cutoff for p-values on those edges. So these are this is a high confidence network that I'm showing you here. So in green, I'm showing you transcriptional activators. In red, we're looking at transcriptional repressors. And then in blue, CLIN3 is one of the G1 cyclins. And we gave it honorary transcription factor status in this particular network because of its ability to act on some of these G1 transcription factors. I'm going to come back to CLIN3 in the second half of the talk in some unpublished data. All right. So you can stare at these kinds of network diagrams, or at least I can, and you can convince yourself, oh yeah, these guys are turning each other on, and they could turn on all of the other genes, and I could get this temporal program of transcription, and I can follow a path through here and kind of restart the whole system, so it looks like it could be an oscillator. But in the end, you can't really tell. There are some people who can tell, and maybe John can look at it and say, yeah, I know how that works. But we couldn't tell, and so we took this network graph, and we turned it into a working model, and we used a framework called a synchronously updating Boolean model. And I don't want to get too deep into how the modeling works here, but the output of this model was a five-state cycle. And it's a little easier to see in this animation. I'm a little embarrassed to call this an animation after our last talk, but yeah. So we see a five-state cycle here. So now you say, oh, you have this semi-cute animation, and you took this network and you circularized it. Of course, it's going to oscillate. What do you really learn from this kind of model? So one of my collaborators is very fond of saying that all models are wrong, but some models are useful. So I'm going to tell you in a little bit why this model is wrong, but I'm going to tell you first why I think it's useful. In this particular modeling format, you can ask some questions about how robust these oscillations are. And the way you do this in a synchronously updating Boolean model is you initialize this model from all possible starting states and ask where the attractors are. And we did this actually across using a number of different Boolean logic gates for the nodes here that have more than one input. And what we found is, depending on what the Boolean logic gates you used were, between 70 to 95% of the time, this model found its way back into a five-step oscillation that looks very, very much like this. So this is the primary attractor was a five-step oscillating attractor. The only other attractor we found was fixed point, all nodes off. All right, so what does that tell you? What it tells you, I think, is that this network architecture has a robust intrinsic oscillating capability. It doesn't tell you it's an oscillator, but it tells you that it has the capability. It's a plausible structure that you might find for a robust oscillator. The only way to really tell is to actually buckle down and do the experiments. All right, so we proposed that the E-cell cycle is entrained to a transcription network oscillator that functions independent of S-phase and mitotic CDKs, independent of cell cycle progression. This thing continued to turn even though the cells were arrested at the G1S border, and that it's one of its roles is to trigger this temporal program of transcription that we see in as cells progress through the cell cycle, and it can produce robust oscillations with a very, very similar period to what we see in wild-type cells. So We have a couple of our collaborators, Josh Schoklar in physics, has been working on some autonomous Boolean models, a little more sophisticated model, and they've been looking at how robust these oscillations are, and that it seems to be holding up. John Hare in mathematics, also doing some Boolean modeling and working on some ODE models right now, which I'm not going to talk about today. All right, so this study brought up as many good questions as it answered, I think. I'm just going to throw out a couple. The one I want to talk about today is, can this network really function independent of all of the cyclin CDKs? These cells still have their G1 cyclins, and I'm going to tell you why that's a problem in a second. But that's certainly one question that we wanted to answer. Another question is, what happens to this oscillator? So we see it turning even though the cells are arrested in the cell cycle. What happens when we perturb the cells in a way that's more physiological? So in response to DNA damage, to x-rays, whatever, cells arrest via checkpoint mechanisms. So what happens to this oscillator when cells arrest in response to checkpoints? And I don't think I'm going to have time to talk about that today, but I have data. If people are interested, we can talk afterwards. And then finally, of course, when you work in budding yeast, you're always inclined to want to know whether what you find is actually being happening in what we call bigger eukaryotes. We're doing some stuff in Drosophila right now as a prelude to hopefully getting into some human cell stuff. So let's go on. Let's talk a little bit about why this network model is wrong. So what we think is wrong with it is that the network's probably more complex. And anytime you work on networks like this, you're always worried that you don't have the whole thing. All right? And we actually prune nodes from that network in the course of undergoing review for our publication. If they had no inputs or outputs, even though we knew they were involved in cell cycle regulated transcription, and we used a pretty conservative cutoff for our edges in terms of p-values. If you relax those restrictions just a little bit, you get a network that's a lot more complicated. In fact, very quickly, this network goes to about 20, 25 nodes, and that's our guess, is that it's going to end up being 20 or 25 nodes. Still not a hairball, but almost tractable. All right, so now I want to talk a little bit. So, yeah, actually, one of our goals is to identify the complete network. What I mean by complete, in part, is when you're doing kind of a network, you have a network that you think is doing some behavior you want to know, what's the smallest box I can draw around this universe of edges that I can make that gives me the behavior that I'm interested in? That's our real goal, is to figure that out. But to some sense, you have to fill out all of the margins before you can do that. All right. So let's talk about CLIN3. So we have CLIN3 in this network. CLIN3 phosphorylates WEE5 is the RB homolog in yeast. So it gets phosphorylated. WEE5 gets phosphorylated by CLIN3, gets kicked off of the activating complexes, and that's how you trigger G1 transcription. All right. But we could have put any of the G1 cyclins into that spot. CLIN1, CLIN2 can do that too. And there's a little problem with that, and that is, especially for CLIN2. CLIN2 is known to be able to, when bound to CDK, activate its own transcription. So we can get a positive feedback loop here. As well, CLIN2 can trigger its own destruction by activating another E3, or actually it phosphorylates itself, which makes it a target for another E3 ubiquitin ligase. So now we have a negative feedback loop here. And so you look at this, and it starts to look a lot like that cyclin B oscillator that I showed you for embryonic systems. So we actually did a couple of experiments. I did a couple of experiments where I actually knocked out both of those edges, and we still could see oscillations. So we weren't too worried that this was actually functioning, because one of the models we have is that the G1 cyclins are the oscillator, and this whole network business is just an output of some oscillator. All right. So we did an experiment here, which kind of helps, but we also did another experiment. We still had it in this network. Does it function in this network? And so what you want to do is do a transcriptional profile and see if you're still seeing these transcriptional oscillations when you get rid of all the cyclin CDK activities. Now, we've done this in a couple of ways. I'm going to show you one. We used a temperature-sensitive mutation in CDK1 called CDC28-4. This is one of the original Hartwell alleles. And this is a lot easier than trying to knock out all 9 cyclins. And CDC28-4 mutant cells arrest in G1 with no apparent periodic activities. These cells don't seem to do anything. when we had the G1 cyclins, we can measure these budding cycles, but these cells don't seem to do anything. And so we did this experiment completely blind, but again, started with cells in early G1, we released them. This is a temperature-sensitive mutant, so you shift the temperature and take time points and look at RNA. And here's what we found, to our great surprise and joy, that and this ends up being probably going to end up being about 600 genes out of that 800 that were oscillating in the B cyclin mutants, or in the S phase of mitotic cyclin mutants. And again, same genes going all the way across. So these are the S phase mitotic cyclin mutants. These cells lack all CDK activities. We still see this program of transcription and genes turning on, turning off, and turning on again. So we're still getting oscillations even in the absence of G1 cyclins. And that suggests that this transcriptional oscillator can function completely independently of cyclin CDK activity. All right. Okay. So we've been building networks for these things. I'm going to try and build. These are big. There we go. And it looks like furballs, I'm sure, for you. I just want to make one point. This is a wild-type network. That's the network for cells lacking S-phase and mitotic cyclins. Here's the one of the early networks that we put together for CDC28-4, and this is work in progress still. But what it turns out, we're not making new networks. This is actually a subset of that network, which is a subset of that network. All right? So we seem to be pruning this thing down as we get rid of cyclin CDK activities. All right. So is there any role for CDKs in regulating this transcriptional oscillator that we appear to be monitoring? And we know for sure that the cyclin CDKs can phosphorylate a number of these transcription factors in this network. And so you'd expect that there was some kind of function for them. And in fact, you can look at little positive feedback loops that the transcription factors turn on a cyclin binds CDK, they activate the transcription factors. And so kind of intuitively, you might expect to see, if we lose these positive feedback loops, that we would see lower amplitudes of expression. And that's actually what we see. This is just an assay of dynamic range for all of those genes that I was showing you in those heat maps. And not much of a difference when you lose just the S phase and mitotic cyclins. But this is just a peak-to-trough ratio here on the x-axis, and the peak-to-trough ratio has definitely dropped for CDC28-4 cells. The other thing that we see is when we start looking at these oscillations, and we're just looking at a single event here, so first event, second event, wild-type S&M cyclins lost, all cyclins lost, what we see is that we do get a bit of an extension of the period. And when we look at all cyclins gone, the slopes for these curves start to lean a little bit. And that suggests that we're getting a little noise here, that these transcriptional oscillations in the absence of CDKs aren't as robust as they are in wild-type cells. So we're proposing now that we have a network oscillator that can function independent of all the cyclin CDKs, but the cyclin CDKs contribute to robust cell cycle oscillations. And I'm just going to finish up with something that's probably obvious for some, but it wasn't so obvious for us, that cyclin CDKs, again, are acting as effectors of this oscillator. All right, so we'll start with our new model for how we view the cell cycle. And at the base of this model is that there's a transcription factor network oscillator that triggers cyclin CDK activity because all of the cyclin expression in these cells is entrained to that transcriptional program. The cyclin CDKs feed back on that transcription network oscillator and keep it oscillating in a robust fashion. And as well, cyclin CDKs trigger cell cycle events. All right? So if it's true that these periodic events are being triggered by the oscillator, by CDKs which are run by the oscillator, then we should be able to change the periodic events we get as we change the cyclins that we have in the cells. Now, I showed you early on that when you don't have any CDK activity, you get no cyclic behaviors. These cells don't do anything. They just sit there and grow. All right? They probably do something, but we haven't been able to find it. If we have the G1 CDKs, the G1 CDKs can trigger budding, and what we see is now we see periodic budding. So this thing, once we hook up the G1 cyclins to it, we see periodic budding. Show you one last bit of data question. What happens when we hook up one of the S-phase cyclins that normally triggers DNA replication. And the cyclin that we chose is CLIB6. So these cells lack all of their mitotic cyclins, but have their G1 cyclins and CLIB6. And CLIB6 is about as analogous to cyclin E as you can get. It's turned on in G1. It's destroyed very rapidly by SCF-CDC4, same mechanism that cyclin E is destroyed by. And in these cells, the oscillator triggers expression of CLIB6 in an oscillating fashion. We also see CLIN2 going up and down. These cells bud and rebud. Big question is, what happens to DNA replication? We can measure replication using flow cytometry. So this is a DNA content analysis. And these cells start off in G1 with a one copy of their genome. And then when we get to the peak level of CLIB6 expression, these cells enter S phase. So you see the shoulder of cells that are accumulating DNA during S phase. They finish S phase and they wait for a bit until you get to the second peak of expression of CLIB6. And these cells enter another S phase without going through mitosis. So we can make these cells go through round after round of DNA replication without mitosis, all driven by a transcriptional oscillator with CLIB6 hooked up to it. All right? I've also shown in another study before, this is a cell, obviously, has gone through a number of different cycles. We see a huge nucleus here in blue, and these green dots, again, are the yeast versions of the centrosome. So these cells also accumulate centrosomes. And this is also a very, very common phenotype in tumor cells. You see multiple centrosomes and polyploidy in tumor cells. All right. So it looks like that these CDKs are really just acting as effectors of the cell cycle oscillator in this case, triggering various cell cycle events in a periodic fashion. All right. And then finally, the last thing that it's pretty clear that this transcription network oscillator, that this all of these genes, these 1,200 genes that are being expressed in this periodic program or in this temporal program, are also contributing to activation of these cell cycle events. A long time ago, a term was coined, just-in-time transcription. If you want to regulate a temporal plan, one way to do it is to turn on genes at the time that they're needed. All right, so I think I'm going to stop there and thank the people who did the work. These are the people in my lab. Most of the work that I showed you was done by Dave Orlando and by Laura Simmons Kovacs, who's looking for a postdoc right now, and all of our collaborators in physics and statistics and mathematics, all part of the Duke Center for Systems Biology. And thanks for your attention, and I'll take questions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ah. Yeah, that's a data display issue, right? So you can order those genes. You can take the same data and order them in any way you want. I did, right? But we ordered the mutants on the left edge of their expression, so the mutants look very clean. And so there's a little wobble. The part of the answer to your question is there's definitely a little wobble. So they don't have to be expressed at the exact same time. And the way we showed that data is we aligned those things on the left edge of expression on mutants and then showed the wild type data. So the wild type looks a little wobbly. If I aligned on wild type, the mutant would look a little wobbly. So it just means they're not exactly expressed at the identical time. We gave them a little play. Other questions? Yeah. Right. So this is something that we've thought about a lot. So as it turns out, and we've done this experiment in cells responding to alpha factor. So cells responding to alpha factor eliminate all CDK activities. And if you synchronize them first by elutriation, then you treat them with alpha factor, you'll see transcription cycles. And so probably as cells are sitting in alpha factor, they're asynchronous with respect to their gene expression. But synchronous with respect to the events of the cell cycle that we care about. What we think happens is that as you release cells from alpha factor, you build up a huge amount of CLIN3, which is a very, very strong G1 activator. So no matter where you are in that program, you're going to enter G1 as soon as you release from alpha factor. Then later on, the B cyclins, we think, can help resynchronize that transcriptional program with the cell cycle. And that's a complicated thing, but I can tell you about it later if you like. Yeah, John. Yeah. I mean, you can do that. So there are a number of mutants that do that. CDC6 is one of them. So if they think that they will only institute the DNA replication checkpoint if they actually start making DNA. So there are so Hartwell didn't see this with the original CDC6 alleles, but they're a little bit leaky. So if you get really tight CDC6 alleles, cells will go right from G1 into mitosis. We haven't been able to do that by screwing around with the cyclins, because the mitotic cyclins are fully competent for triggering DNA replication. And before you can enter mitosis, they'll trigger DNA replication, and then checkpoints will prevent you from going into mitosis. Right. So we didn't talk about checkpoints. Yeah. So we've been doing a bunch of work, and that would be a whole other talk, but we can talk about that later. Yeah.
I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah.
But if I say the model again, it would be sort of systems and coupled ODEs.
Right.
So when you have a large, if you have a lot of, you know, your network that's quite complicated, you have a complex system of coupled ODEs.
Right.
How do you know whether there's a, I mean, when you're given a system like that, there's no, let's say, a stable affinity solution to that system, or is there some technique for it?
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely asking the wrong person. Do you have thoughts on that, John? The question is if you get a topology like that and a series of ODE equations, how do you know that you're getting a stable oscillation?
Or that the one exists.
Basically. Or that a stable oscillation exists. Mm-hmm. Right. So we've done that in simulation, and the problem without having negative feedback is that if you put a little noise into the system, and Josh has been doing this in the autonomous Boolean match.